Are you a down-on-your-luck dictator who deliberately killed your own servicemen, but don't want the public to find out? A deep state operator who blew the president's head off in broad daylight, but want to get away with it scot-free? A swamp dweller with some uncomfortable ties to the most infamous pedophile of modern times that you'd rather the public not know about? Well, fret no more. Today on The Corbett Report, I present you with your guide to how to stage a cover-up.
You're listening to The Corbett Report.
Welcome back, friends. Welcome back to another edition of The Corbett Report. I'm your host, James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, coming to you, as always, from the sunny climes of Western Japan, here in April of 2026, with episode 498 of The Corbett Report podcast, How to Stage a Cover-Up. And yes, I don't think the premise of today's podcast episode will need a great deal of elaboration for certainly anyone in my longtime audience, or really anyone in the general population with two brain cells to rub together, who have observed that government commissions of inquiry and investigations tend to find that the government did nothing wrong. In fact, so oft repeated is that phrase that it has become a meme. We have investigated ourselves and found nothing wrong. So, as I say, I think we all know examples of this phenomenon, but today let's examine 9 specific examples from the past century of history of government cover-ups to see how they function and see what we can glean from that information. I think there is some very interesting and instructive information in these examples. But before we dive into those examples, let's start with a general observation about how these government inquiries tend to function, how they bake the results of their investigation into the cake of their inquiries from the get-go. And for this observation, we're going to turn to Dr. Tim Ball, who I'm sure my longtime audience will be familiar with. If you are not familiar with Dr. Ball or his work as one of the lone voices in the wilderness crying out against the climate madness in the early 21st century, back when it was unpopular to do so, please see my episode from a few years ago, Remembering Tim Ball, which I recorded, of course, on hearing the news of the passing of that warrior for truth. But today, let's turn back to a conversation I recorded with him in his home in Victoria back in 2009, where he was talking about his experience serving on various government commissions of inquiry and discovering how they take the result and put it into the very formulation of those commissions in the first place.
My name is Dr. Timothy Ball, and I have a PhD in climatology from the Queen Mary College at the University of London, England. My experience of having chaired commissions of inquiry for government or being on commissions of inquiry with government is that commissions of inquiry with government are there are certain things that politicians love. Commissions of inquiry are one of them. Deficits are another, because with a deficit, they can say, oh, sorry, we can't afford that. But then if they want to do something suddenly, magically, then the money's there. If there's a problem or a conflict that develops and it's causing a lot of difficulty for the politicians, they can say, oh, we will appoint a commission of inquiry. It'll be independent. And that takes the heat off the issue. Oh, yeah, the government's reacting. They're finally appointed a commission of inquiry. And then if they don't, of course, they say, oh, you're afraid to put one on. You know, you're hiding something. So, okay, we appoint the commission of inquiry. But then what people don't realize is they control the outcome of that commission of inquiry. Now, first of all, they've got the advantage now because if the media come and say, well, what's going on? Can't talk about it. Commission of Inquiry. Wait till their report comes out. Well, that delays usually 2, 3, 4 years, by which time all the political heat's off. But more important is they control it by the terms of reference. And the example I like to use is the Warren Commission inquiry into Kennedy's assassination. And Judge Warren was asked about something after. He said, well, why didn't you look? Oh, it wasn't in my terms of reference. He'd been limited by those that wrote the terms of reference. And that was my experience. One of the first cases I was asked to look at, and the minister said, He said, would you look at this? And I said, sure. And then I get the terms of reference. And I say, I can't work with that. I can't provide you with a proper answer, a complete answer with those terms of reference. So, of course, then the minister says, well, sorry, that's what you got to work with. And I say, fine, then I'm not doing the job. And I'll go to the media and say, you're trying to limit the investigation here. So I could one-up him with that. And so when they set up the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, Maurice Strong, who we should talk a lot about, he wrote the terms of reference. And the first term of reference was the definition of climate change. And he limited it deliberately to only human causes of climate change. And, of course, that effectively eliminated all the natural causes, natural variability, which is why you see them not looking at things like the sun and a whole bunch of other issues.
Once again, that was Dr. Tim Ball talking about how the terms of reference of a commission of inquiry can be used to direct the outcome of that inquiry, a point which should be pretty obvious once it's pointed out to you. And yet, how many people actually bother to go and read the terms of reference of the various commissions of inquiry that are appointed to cover up various government activities? I would venture to say very few, but it can be a fruitful endeavor, as Dr. Tim Ball goes on to explain there. And as I have talked about in greater detail elsewhere, the terms of reference were very much part of baking into the cake the conclusion that anthropogenic global warming was the cause of climate change in our world, which was not scientifically valid or accurate, but was, by terms of reference, the commissions of inquiry and the various conventions that were signed were obligated to find that. If you would like more information about that and how that worked in that context, I have talked about that more. For example, in Questions for Corbett number 96, is the IPCC rigged? We go through a deep dive where I go to the specific terms in the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change that specifically define climate change in the precise way Dr. Tim Ball was talking about there. But let's look at that in the context of government cover-ups and how they function. And let's see if that has ever been used in history. Oh, wait, yes, of course it has. Let's look at one of the most obvious and prime examples of a government cover-up in the past century, the cover-up of Pearl Harbor. Presumably, my dedicated Corbett reporters in the crowd will know that Pearl Harbor was not what the government said it was, a surprise attack out of nowhere. Who could have seen it coming? I hope that my well-informed listeners are already aware of the various flaws in that official story of Pearl Harbor. But if not, you can look at some of my work on that subject in the past. For example, I do a quick, brief, to the point and information loaded summary of the Pearl Harbor false flag in Debunking a Century of War Lies. So please do see that if you are interested in more information. I've also talked to Robert Stinnett, who was one of the premier researchers on this subject back on Corbett Report Radio, episode 50, Deconstructing Pearl Harbor, where I talked to Robert Stinnett about his work on Day of Deceit, the truth about FDR and Pearl Harbor, his magnum opus on the subject, and one that is filled with information about the actual, how the attack actually unfolded, what was known beforehand, etc., and also talks to in some degree of detail about the cover-up that took place as a result of it. But long story short, for people who don't know, essentially, of course, America was outraged. How could this possibly have happened? How did the Japanese sneak attack us? How did no one know? Who is to blame? And in the wake of this outrage from the public, of course, President Roosevelt set up his own commission of inquiry to lay the blame of the entire Pearl Harbor incident squarely on the shoulders of two men, Navy Admiral Husband E. Kimmel and Army General Walter Short, the commanders at Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, who ended up getting blamed for everything. And you see how that eventually played out. Of course, the commission was first appointed in December of 1941. By February, it had already come back with its judgment and It was not a kind one for Kimmel and Short, and we get a flavor of that from this contemporaneous New York Times report from March of 1942. Kimmel and Short will stand trial. Date is undecided. Courts martial on charges of dereliction of duty at Pearl Harbor ordered based on Roberts report. Applications of Admiral and General for retirement on $6,000 pay are granted. Kimmel and Short will stand trial. And this goes on to talk about the charge against both officers of dereliction of duty that would be laid on them by the president's special investigating committee in a report presented by Associate Justice Owen J. Roberts of the Supreme Court, the chairman of that panel, to Mr. Roosevelt on January 24th. Yada, yada. Long story short, Kimmel and Short were completely dragged through the mud and were blamed for everything at Pearl Harbor, top to bottom. There are many, many, many reasons that to exonerate Kimmel and Short. And as people may or may not know, the Kimmel family, I know, has been greatly involved in a long, decades-long effort to simply get Kimmel's rank posthumously restored. And even that has been this decades-long, incredibly nightmarish journey for the family. Now that we know that so much information was withheld from Kimmel and Short, so much of the blame that they was placed on their shoulders was not their responsibility, which we now know because we know that it was a cover-up. The Roberts panel that was created by Roosevelt was a cover-up committee. So again, this is mainstream history at this point that Kimmel and Short were railroaded. It was a kangaroo commission that basically was going to lay blame on them beforehand, before it even started. And how do we know that? Because it was in the terms of reference, exactly as Dr. Tim Ball was pointing out. I would like to give the hat tip to Tom Jake, who, as I understand, is a local historian in husband E. Kimmel's hometown, who has talked about this case in great detail in a lecture he gave several years ago, Admiral Husband E. Kimmel Betrayed, in which he points out, yes, it was in the terms of reference of that Roberts commission that basically, again, it was baked into the cake before it even sat down. So here is the final report of this Roberts Commission, attack upon Pearl Harbor by Japanese armed forces. And right there in the preamble, right there in the first lines, in the third paragraph, the purposes, this was the executive order, which was issued by Roosevelt there in December of 1941. The purposes of the required inquiry and report are to provide bases for sound decisions whether any derelictions of duty or errors of judgment on the part of United States Army or Navy personnel contributed to such successes as were achieved by the enemy. So there, did you catch it? It's right there for you. On the part of the United States Army or Navy personnel, i.e. no civilian will be looked at as having any part contributing to the success of the enemy in the Pearl Harbor. No one in the civilian chain of command or anywhere else. We're just going to look at U.S. Army or Navy personnel. So right there, limiting it in that way, they start to bake it into the cake. And of course, in the time-honored tradition of whoever's in charge is the one to blame, well, Kimmel and Short got the short end of that stick. And as I say, it's an ongoing story. You can read or listen or hear some of the lectures and interviews and petitioning and other things that the husband Kimmel's descendants have been engaged in for years, trying to clear his name, and how much they are, shall we say, angry with the government at the fact that they still continue to perpetrate this cover-up about Pearl Harbor. Lots more information about this case, and in fact, all of the cases that I'm going to talk about today. We're only covering the overview here. So if you want to deep dive into these materials, please go to corbettreport.com/coverup for the complete transcript with all of the hyperlinks to everything that I am citing today. But let's get straight into the second example that we're going to look at today. The Warren Commission. Yes, you know the Warren Commission, the one that concluded, of course, that JFK was just some crazy lone nut who just decided to go out there and shoot him. And there you go. Case closed, guys. It was a lone nut. Never have to think about JFK ever again. Of course, that did not happen, and many people pointed out that the Warren Commission was flawed in many, many, many supremely, incredibly, foundationally important ways, and was, again, was a railroad investigation that was never meant to come to any actual truth, but only to cover up that truth. Much has been said about this in the past, so I will not attempt to encapsulate all of the problems with the Warren Commission here, but I will point to one specific example that again goes to show another way that cover-ups can function, how a government inquiry, an independent commission, can be from its very inception loaded. The dice can be loaded so that it will come up with cover-up every single time. In this case, one does not have to look very far. In fact, rather than terms of reference, how about the composition of the commission itself? Who will sit on this commission of inquiry into the assassination of the President of the United States? How about one of the prime suspects as one of the conspirators involved in that assassination? In this case, of course, talking about Alan Dulles, who was the former director of Central Intelligence, the person who was in that position when JFK entered as president in January 1961, but who was not president by the time, was not director by the time of President Kennedy's assassination in November of 1963, because of course, Kennedy had unceremoniously kicked him out the door and replaced him with McCone. And why did he replace him? Oh, a little thing called the Bay of Pigs and that whole debacle. And as we all know, and hopefully you do know about this in great detail, because I've talked about it many times and many, many other people have as well. Of course, Kennedy was absolutely furious at the deep state that existed underneath his administration at that time, that was clearly plotting against him and around him and without his knowledge. And he laid a lot of that blame on the doorstep of the CIA, who he infamously said he was going to break into 1,000 pieces and scatter those pieces to the winds. And one can imagine there was not a lot of love from Kennedy for Alan Dulles. So when JFK gets his head blown off in clear daylight, who does LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, the next president of the United States, appoint to sit on the cover-up commission that would ultimately go on to cover up the details of that assassination? Of course, none other than Alan Dulles.
We're going to name very shortly a presidential commission made up of 7 people, 2 from the House, 2 from the Senate, and 3. 2 from the public and 1 from the court. As a study group to go into this FBI report, this court of inquiry, and all the incidents connection to the assassination of our beloved friend, and you've got to go on that for me.
You think I can really serve you?
I know you can. There's not a doubt about it. Just get ready now to go in there and do a good job. We've got to have America's got to be united in this hour, and
I wouldn't want to help, and you consider that my previous work, my previous job.
Are you sure you want to do that, Mr. President? You know about my work and what I've done in the past.
Yes, and you're the man for the job. Go in there and cover it up.
Yes, sir.
Case closed. And we all know what happened as a result of that. And if you don't happen to know what happened as a result of the Warren Commission and Dulles' involvement in it and all of the various pieces of that puzzle, you might want to see some of the work that I've done on that over the years. For example, my highly relevant episode on Meet Alan Dulles, Fascist Spymaster, and of course, my more recent lecture on JFK from Mongoose to Gladio, which fills in some of the pieces of that puzzle. But yes, long story short, another way to run a cover-up commission is to make sure that the people serving on that commission have a direct interest in participating in the cover-up, covering up their own crimes, as it were. That seems like it's probably something that might be used more than once in history. So let's keep this list rolling. Let's look at the next specific example of we investigated ourselves and found nothing cover-up. Iran-Contra. You know and remember Iran-Contra from the 1980s, when, of course, the U.S. government and various people operating within the Reagan administration were involved in a blatantly illegal scheme to sell arms to Iran in order to fund the Contras in Nicaragua in direct violation of the Boland Amendments, which Congress had passed a series of laws which had specifically prohibited further funding of the Contras. So this was A, a conspiracy, and B, blatantly illegal, but it happened. And what happened, what resulted from that completely, flagrantly illegal scheme? Well, pretty much nothing. Of course, there were a series of indictments of various people and even some convictions. But all of those convictions were either overturned on appeal or pardons were issued when Bush came in the door after Reagan departed. So basically nothing came of it. It was an effective cover-up, so-called by one of the chief investigators of the Reagan administration's antics at the time. But that cover-up, although there are a lot of interesting and fascinating pieces of it, not only, of course, Oliver North and what became of him and his role in American politics, but also John Poindexter and what he went on to do with the Total Information Awareness Office and his role in helping Thiel starting Palantir, etc. Again, I've talked about those issues in the past, but let's look at a specific moment within what ultimately ended up being the Iran-Contra cover-up, in which another truth accidentally almost emerged into public view. But right there on the spot, we had one of these brave Congress critters gaveling down to make sure that a cover-up of that potential side truth be affected right there on the spot.
Colonel North, in your work at the NSC, were you not assigned at one time to work on plans for the continuity of government in the event of a major disaster?
Mr. Chairman,
I believe that question touches upon a highly sensitive and classified area, so may I request that you not touch upon that, sir.
I was particularly concerned, Mr. Chairman, because I read in Miami papers and several others that there had been a plan developed by that same agency, a contingency plan in the event of emergency that would suspend the American Constitution. And I was deeply concerned about it and wondered if that was the area in which he had worked. I believe
I most respectfully request that that matter not be touched upon at this stage. If we wish to get into this, I'm certain arrangements can be made for an executive session.
Wow, just brilliant, just brilliant. I think you have to hand it to Senator Inouye there, scrambling to come up with some sort of, I think we're going to take that behind closed doors if you keep going in that direction, way to cover up something that almost got released there in Congress. They almost broached a subject that was a no-no subject, but man, he gaveled down on that quick enough, didn't he? And just for the record, yeah, that's the same Senator Inouye who gave these sterling speeches about this shadow government with its own shadow navy and army that operates outside of the law. Still to this day, you see clips of that. It's venerated. But this is the same guy who was actively working to cover up any hint of what that deep state was actually involved in. So there you go. That's another way. That's perhaps the most effective way to gavel down when something is about to be released. Just say, sorry, the public can't hear about that. And boom, it's gone. All right, let's continue with this cavalcade of conspiracy to the next obvious false flag cover-up of modern times. That would, of course, be 9/11. And we all know about the 9/11 Commission and the cover-up that it involved. And if you don't know about that, well, I've spoken about that quite a bit in the past as well. So you can see some of my previous work on that. And perhaps starting with, or at least continuing your exploration with, my analysis of 9/11 suspect Philip Zelikow, who, again, I'm sure my well-informed audience will be aware, was parachuted in after Heinz Kissinger turned out not to be the kind of person they wanted to put as the face of this commission, someone that even the New York Times said was clearly a sign that Bush was trying to cover up 9/11 rather than get to the truth. So they threw Kissinger out the door and they brought in Philip Zelikow, who's this guy? Let me check my notes. Oh, that's right. He's co-authored a book with Condi Rice. He's been in the neocon circles. He definitely has conflicts of interest. Sounds like the kind of guy that can go in there and make sure that a cover-up gets done. And boy, did he make sure a cover-up got done. The most remarkable example of Zelikow's dictatorial control came in March 2003, just 3 months after the commission's 16-month investigation began. It was at that time, before the commission had even convened a single hearing, that Zelikow, along with longtime associate and commission consultant Ernest May, co-wrote a complete outline of the final report.
Before the staff even had its first meeting, Zelikow had written, along with his former professor Ernest May, a detailed outline of the commission's report, complete, as Sheenan put it, with chapter headings, subheadings, and sub-subheadings. When Kane and Hamilton were later shown this outline, they worried that it would be seen as evidence that the report's outcome had been predetermined. So the three of them decided to keep it a secret from the rest of the staff. When the staff did finally learn about this outline a year later, they were alarmed. Some of them circulated a parody entitled "The Warren Commission Report, Preemptive Outline." One of his chapter headings read, "Single bullet, we haven't seen the evidence yet, but really, we're sure." The implication was that the crucial chapter in the Zelikow May outline could have been headed, "Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, we haven't seen the evidence yet, but really, we're sure."
You know, you gotta hand it to Zelikow, because he managed to find an even more direct way of baking the conclusion into the commission cake. You don't have to worry about terms of reference. You just literally rewrite the entire report in advance, or at least all of the headings and subheadings and sub-subheadings, so that there's no way the commission can possibly conclude anything than what you want them to conclude. Again, you do not have to go out on the conspiracy limb for this information. Mainstream history, for example, Philip Sheenan writing about the commission, the uncensored history of the 9/11 investigation, documents that particular factoid in detail. So you can check that out. While you're checking out, of course, your edition of the 9/11 Commission Report, in which you will find, if you bother to go through all of the footnotes and take a look, more than one quarter of all of the footnotes, all of the evidence that was presented in this 9/11 Commission final report that was written in advance, essentially, more than one quarter of all the footnotes source back to torture testimony. Of course, completely inadmissible in any court of law, and for good reason, because torture does not produce reliable information. It produces whatever the torturers want to hear. And that is precisely why this is, well, that's one of the reasons why this is absolute unreliable garbage, a fairy tale from top to bottom, start to finish. And when the reality of the torture testimony, not only for the 9/11 Commission report, the basis of that, but the entire war of terror started to come out, and we started to have at least an attempt to at least give some sort of fig leaf of a pretense of, don't worry, guys, we're going to look into this and get to the bottom of it. Oh, wouldn't you know it, the CIA went and covered it up. And how did they do it? They took the extraordinary, amazing idea of destroying the evidence. Okay, maybe that's not such an original or inventive idea for covering something up, but A, it is effective, and B, in this particular case, it was not just run-of-the-mill illegal. It was blatantly, absolutely, brazenly illegal, essentially daring the U.S. justice system to do anything about this blatantly illegal act. Oh, do you remember the time that the CIA destroyed tight tapes of these enhanced interrogations despite court orders? Yes, Pepperidge Farm remembers. The Bush administration was under court order not to discard evidence of detainee torture and abuse months before the CIA destroyed videotapes that revealed some of its harshest interrogation tactics. Normally, that would force the government to defend itself against obstruction allegations, but the CIA may have an out. Its clandestine network of overseas prisons. See, they were using black sites that weren't really on the books anyway, so maybe they can get away with it. Well, they did. I guess they did, because they did destroy the tapes in direct contravention of court orders in November 2005. And wait, let's see, how many people involved in that decision or in that completely, clearly, brazenly, 100% illegal act have even been brought before a judge to answer for it, let alone sentenced for it. I'm thinking that's rounded to the nearest whole number, zero. Big fat goose egg, right? Now, this report was from 2007. Of course, as it later turned out, it was even worse. Back in 2009, it was admitted that the CIA destroyed 92 interrogation tapes. The CIA has destroyed nearly 100 interrogation tapes of terror suspects, a number far greater than was previously acknowledged by the agency. So they even lied about how much illegal stuff they did to cover up. But you can trust them when they say 92, guys. They really mean it this time. If the Boland Amendments aren't going to stop the deep state from perpetrating Iran-Contra, then no amount of judge orders or court orders are going to stop the CIA from destroying their torture tapes. Am I right? Of course I'm right. And what was the result of this blatantly illegal act? Obviously, people went to jail, there were trials, there was there was nothing. Of course not. Nobody suffered any accountability for this blatantly illegal act. If you would like more information about this whole episode and all of the information surrounding it, all of the other crazy information surrounding it, like, hey, remember that time the CIA hacked the Senate's computers? Remember that? Again, what happened? Nothing. If you would like more information on that, you should see my report on torturing the truth. But let's move right along to the next cover-up on our list here. Do you remember ClimateGate? Well, if you've been around in this space for long enough, maybe that name rings a bell. Maybe it doesn't. And if it doesn't, what are you going to do? How are you going to find more information about ClimateGate? Well, of course, you go to your favorite search engine, Google, and you type in ClimateGate. And of course, the very first link is going to be, oh, good old handy-dandy Wikipedia, the bastion of truth. But of course, they don't call it ClimateGate. That's what those conspiracy theorists called it back in the time. No, this is the Climatic Research Unit email controversy. And this helpfully explains that this email controversy began in November 2009 with the hacking of a server at the Climatic Research Unit at the University of East Anglia by an external attacker, probably the Russians or something, dot, dot, dot. Who cares? Anyway, details, schmetails. Yes, the emails from the CRU at the UEA. And again, my longtime listeners will know about these emails and their significance. But if you don't, you can continue reading where it was talked about how the story was first broken by climate change denialists who argued that the emails showed that global warming was a scientific conspiracy and that scientists manipulated climate data and attempted to suppress critics. But that can't possibly be true. Well, read down far enough and you'll find, oh, alas, yay, it's not true. Eight committees investigated the allegations and published reports finding no evidence of fraud or scientific misconduct. Case closed, guys. Eight committees investigated. I mean, you can throw one cover-up committee at, you know, the assassination of the president or 9/11 or something like that. We're going to throw eight committees investigating this controversy, and that'll shut up the critics, right? Of course, the only problem with these eight committees that investigated, they were top to bottom cover-up investigations that were parodies of investigations, and there is no reason to take any one of them seriously. Let's get to the heart of the debunking, which has apparently taken place of climate. It's been multiple inquiries have debunked this, hasn't there been?
Yes, they had, around six, maybe seven even, of these reports. And what it essentially amounted to, and this was right after ClimateGate, first of all, they tried to ignore ClimateGate. And this was a key thing. There was really, the establishment basically thought it was much ado about nothing and just let it go, which was, I always say, I remember being quoted in Newsweek magazine thanking the global warming establishment and the establishment media for ignoring ClimateGate because it allowed climate skeptics to bring out and basically expose it without all that interference from the media and pushback. But a few months later, they realized this is serious. It was so serious, by the way. People like climatologist Judith Curry, who was a convinced believer of the climate crisis, literally switched her view and became a skeptic within almost less than a year from reading these emails. That's how powerful it was. But they came out with all these different committees, including Penn State did an inquiry, multiple UK inquiries, including East Anglia. The Associated Press did their own analysis through all the emails. And their whole goal was this basically amounts to the global warming establishment essentially investigating itself and declaring that they were fine and there was nothing to be seen here. And in committee after committee basically went through, and they had people on it with vested interests. Some of the UK committees actually had renewable energy advocates and people receiving mass subsidies who would directly benefit from climate policy running the inquiries. The Penn State committee that investigated Michael Mann, and I don't make this up, I actually quote it, literally concluded that because Michael Mann was so quoted in the media and made so much money for the university, he couldn't possibly have done anything wrong. And that's not, you know, one of the analysts said this was a parody of an investigation, that these words were actually in the report. But the media didn't actually even quote any of those outrageous quotes. They just said, oh, Penn State has exonerated Michael Mann. But the global warming establishment investigated itself and declared that it was okay. And by the way, there's no other industry where you can investigate yourself like that. Usually you would appoint independent outside groups, but you know, this is what they did. And then they moved on.
That was a short clip from my conversation with Mark Morano on ClimateGate Rebunked, in which he pointed out some of the many, many flaws with these so-called investigations or parodies of investigations. He makes a lot of money for the university. Therefore, he can't have done these things. Great defense. Yes, the idea that eight committees have debunked ClimateGate is total nonsense. And there's a lot more evidence along those lines that I've talked about in the past. But actually, it isn't even the committees of investigation that were top to bottom conflicts of interest and cover-ups that was the way in which that cover-up was fundamentally affected. No, in fact, it was the idea that we needed committees of investigation to somehow debunk things that are perfectly readable by your own two eyes is itself the cover-up in that case. These are matters of record. You can go and read the emails in which the scientists were literally conspiring to keep people they didn't like with ideas they didn't like out of the peer-reviewed record. There's no denying that. There's nothing you can say about that. It is there in black and white, along with all of the other pieces of that ClimateGate puzzle. If you would like to know more about the actual details of what was actually discovered and uncovered there for your own two eyes to see in the ClimateGate emails, please see my report on the subject, ClimateGate is Still the Issue. I've done a lot of work on this subject over the years, but that one is a good encapsulation of some of the most egregious things that were discovered in that tranche of emails and the way that it was, they attempted to cover it up. But let's take another look at the cover-up idea and how it is affected. And let's see if we can find another tactic, which is sometimes used to cover up events after the fact. Intimidation, of course. If all signs point to there's somebody out there who's going to blow the whistle, or there's somebody who's got information we don't like, well, you can either take care of them by getting them out of the picture, as, for example, many of the people who weren't called to the Warren Commission weren't called because they met mysterious ends in various ways. But sometimes you just go and intimidate the witnesses to make sure that they end up not or going along with what you want them to go along with. So in this specific case, we're going to turn to another cover-up, the Duma cover-up. Do you remember the April 2018 dastardly attack by the animal Assad on his own people there in the suburbs of Damascus, where he dropped at least two cylinders containing chemical weapons on residential areas in which he was fighting with the freedom fighters who were attacking the Syrian forces there. That's right. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm struggling to keep the narrative together. Yes. And of course, we all know Assad, the suicidal monster, decided to drop chemical weapons on his own population, crossing the red line that he knew was the thing that would result in military intervention, outside military intervention by NATO forces on his soil. And lo and behold, just a few days after that chemical attack took place, of course, the U.S. and its allies started dropping bombs on Syria. You remember all of that, right? Well, of course, you remember it incorrectly, if that's the way you remember it, because what was the evidence that there was a chemical attack of any sort that took place in Duma in April 2018, let alone that it was dropped by Syrian forces? Oh, that's right. It comes from an OPCW investigation that after 5 years, eventually concluded that, yes, it was the Syrian forces. Of course, it only took about 5 days for the strikes to start, but it took 5 years for the investigation to finally wrap up. And why is that? It's because, oh, there were a few bumps along the way of that investigation. If you would like to know more about that, boy, do I have a story to tell you. It's called The Duma Hoax, Anatomy of a False Flag. And that, for those who haven't seen it, is a deep dive into the narrative that was constructed about the Duma attack and how it was undermined, not only by outside researchers, investigators, but by the OPCW, the organization that is tasked with investigating these types of events. Their own fact-finding mission, their FFM team, was writing reports, draft reports, that contradicted the idea that there was any chemical attack at all. There was no evidence that there was an actual chemical attack that took place, according to the OPCW FFM's own investigators, at least until the OPCW team decided to force some outside U.S. agents into the matter to convince the team that they saw what they saw, which is chemical weapons. Steele's article recounts multiple interventions on behalf of OPCW management to try to placate the incensed scientists of the FFM who felt that their investigation was being undermined. Quote, on July 4th, there was another intervention. Fairweather, the chef de cabinet, invited several members of the drafting team to his office. There, they found three U.S. officials who were cursorily introduced, without making clear which U.S. agencies they represented. The Americans told them emphatically that the Syrian regime had conducted a gas attack, and that the two cylinders found on the roof and upper floor of the building contained 170 kilograms of chlorine. The inspectors left Fairweather's office feeling that the invitation to the Americans to address them was unacceptable pressure and a violation of the OPCW's declared principles of independence and impartiality, end quote. Steele told BBC News that he believed that the entire incident had been a fake propaganda event staged by the Jaish al-Islam terrorists to bring American intervention into the region against their Syrian enemies. Now, if you're unfamiliar with the Duma hoax in general, I would highly suggest you take a look at that full report, because there are some wild twists and turns in that story. But long story short, yes, the OPCW was part, organizationally, institutionally, of a cover-up. The inspectors on the ground seemed to be accurately reporting what they were finding, but those accurate reports did not find their way into the final report, and there was a lot going on, including, of course, intimidation by U.S. government representatives who showed up. Who are they? What agency do they represent? Well, a cursory introduction later, they're telling us what we saw on the ground. You better believe those investigators understood they were being intimidated in that moment. So that's another way that these types of operations can be run. Let's look at more examples. Let's go to number 8 on our list of cover-ups. And of course, we have to talk about COVID, the defining moment of our lives, everybody, the incredible pandemic that locked us all down and we all had to, it was a hoax that was then covered up. And we can get that from many different examples, but let's take a look at one specific example of this that I wrote about last November, Can the COVID Scamsters Stick the Landing?, where I talked about the UK COVID-19 inquiry, which people might have heard about. If you're in the UK, you probably heard about it. If you're not, you might have seen some of the headlines that came out about it, where, oh my God, it's a good thing that we locked everyone down, because what would have happened otherwise? Specifically, I write here that the UK COVID-19 inquiry delivered its verdict that the lockdowns the UK government imposed during the scamdemic were too little too late, and that they could have saved 23,000 lives by locking down earlier. What a precise number. This is, of course, nonsense. Actually, it's worse than nonsense. It's nonsense based on made-up numbers from a known liar. And I point to this Off-Guardian tweet. To be clear, when Baroness What's-Her-Name says all the evidence suggests an earlier lockdown would have saved 23,000 lives, the evidence she's referring to is one modeling paper written by a man who thought lockdown was so pointless he broke it to visit his own mistress. Of course. For those who don't know, the tweet is referring to this passage from the inquiry's report. Professor Ferguson told the inquiry that in later work, which analyzed the impact of restrictions in England, we explicitly modeled the counterfactual scenario of moving the lockdown of 23rd March back to 16th March, and estimated mortality would have been reduced by 48%. This could have equated to a reduction in deaths in England from 48,600 to approximately 25,600 in the first wave up to 1 July 2020. Professor Ferguson is, lest we forget, Neil Ferguson, the virus modeler, or should that be the liberal Lysenko, from Imperial College London, who produced the computer model suggesting that 500,000 Britons were destined for the grave unless the UK government imposed a national lockdown. Ferguson has since walked back that claim and now denies calling for a lockdown at all, but it should be kept in mind that his about-face came after he was caught breaking the UK lockdown restrictions to carry on an affair with his married lover. I'll end the quote there. There's more to that story. But yes, this is another great way of getting the claim out there at any rate, because I'm sure a lot of people in the UK and elsewhere heard that dramatic claim. We could have saved 23,000 lives by locking down earlier. But who is going to bother to actually read the report, actually find that claim in the report, and then actually follow that claim through to its reference to find out where it's coming from and how those numbers were arrived at? Not one in a thousand people would do that. If they did, they'd discover that, of course, it's a pile of nonsense, turtles all the way down, just trust us, bro, etc. Those are the types of ways that you can take a claim that you want to be out there in the public and make it a big headline news story that will be graciously and slavishly covered by the establishment press because, hey, you said it in an official report in an official setting. It doesn't matter if it was all statistical nonsense based on bad science. It's in the official record now. What are you going to do about it? So that's another way that these types of cover-ups can be affected. We've looked at a lot of different ways that cover-ups can be affected in today's episode. We've looked at the ways to set the terms of reference of an inquiry, or just to control who's going to be on the investigation committee, or to intimidate witnesses, or to control what fake and phony statistics and scientific facts get entered into the record. All of these other ways that you can actually take real information about the real world and then cover it up by a sleight of hand. So here's the question. Given what we've learned from the first eight examples, can we identify a cover-up that is taking place in real time as it is happening?
Attorney General Bondi, why did you publicly claim to have the Epstein client list waiting for your review and then produce nothing relevant to that claim?
Senator Durbin, if you listen to my entire clip on that, I said I had not reviewed it yet, that it was sitting on my desk along with the JFK files, the Martin Luther King files. And I said I had not yet reviewed it. And if you see our memo on Epstein, you will see, our memo on Epstein clearly points out that there was no client list.
You said Jeffrey Epstein committed suicide. People don't believe it.
Well, I mean, listen, they have a right to their opinion, but as someone who has worked as a public defender, as a prosecutor, who's been in that prison system, who's been in the Metropolitan Detention Center, who's been in segregated housing, you know a suicide when you see one, and that's what that was.
He killed himself. I've seen the whole file.
Of course. And so we arrive at the ninth and final example of today's cavalcade of cover-ups, the Epstein cover-up. Yes, of course, we all know at this point that a cover-up is ongoing, has been ongoing for decades, really, at this point, but certainly in a concerted and concentrated fashion in the past year or two. And we can all see it happening right there, spilling out on the daily news feeds. Yes, this is a cover-up. We can see it happening in real time. And what can we learn from it? What tactics are being employed here? Well, just as one obvious example, we have media complicity in this cover-up, both mainstream establishment media and alternative media.
I've had this interview with Virginia Roberts. We would not put it on the air. First of all, I was told, who's Jeffrey Epstein? No one knows who that is. This is a stupid story. Then the palace found out that we had her whole allegations about Prince Andrew and threatened us a million different ways. we were so afraid we wouldn't be able to interview Kate and Will that we that also quashed the story. And then Alan Dershowitz was also implicated in because of the planes. She told me everything. She had pictures. She had everything. She was in hiding for 12 years. We convinced her to come out. We convinced her to talk to us. It was unbelievable what we had. Clinton. We had everything.
Conservative political commentators were spotted at the White House holding binders labeled the Epstein Files just hours after Attorney General Pam Bondi pledged transparency in the release of the documents. The Justice Department has yet to release the documents to the general public, leaving many to question what exactly was in the binders. Among those seen holding the binders were prominent right-wing figures, including Rogan O'Handley, Mike Cernovich, Jack Posobiec, and Kaya Rakic, also known as Libs of TikTok.
What you're going to see, hopefully tomorrow, is a lot of flight logs, a lot of names, a lot of information, but it's pretty sick what that man did.
And we have plea deals, that magical courtroom device by which everyone involved in some ongoing crime can benefit. Not only the accused who are directly implicated in the crime, but of course all of their accomplices and co-conspirators who can get covered under the seal of the plea deal. We can talk about other connections that happened in the first Trump administration. For example, we all know by now that Trump's labor secretary in his first term, Alex Acosta, was the one who signed off on Epstein's sweetheart plea deal back in the early or in the 2000s, back when Epstein was first arrested for soliciting underage prostitutes. And he got that sweetheart deal and everything got swept under the rug. And he got a little slap on the wrist because of the plea deal that he managed to make with Alex Acosta. And Acosta, we know, said he was told to leave Epstein alone because he, quote, belonged to intelligence. We know that Trump did, when Ghislaine Maxwell was arrested, wish her well. Not once, but twice. He doubled down on it. Yes, he absolutely does wish Ghislaine Maxwell well. And, well, she is doing well at this point, because, of course, we know she was arrested and sentenced for trafficking underage girls to no one, apparently. But we do know that she is now at Club Fed, or should that be Camp Cupcake? Ghislaine Maxwell allowed unlimited amount of toilet paper in Camp Cupcake Prison, in which she's apparently writing letters talking about how much she's enjoying her new stay in her new digs. And oh, by the way, her fellow prison inmates are petrified of Ghislaine Maxwell and the power that she seems to wield over this minimum security prison that she's been shoveled off to as she woos Trump for an early release. And why on earth would she expect that? Oh, that's right. Because, of course, as we all remember earlier this year, Ghislaine Maxwell, who wants a pardon, says she never saw Trump in any appropriate setting. Wow, okay, perfectly on the level there. What level? I will leave you to decide for yourself. And how about intimidation of witnesses? Well, have we heard any threats to various people being kicked around as a result of what they may or may not know about the Epstein saga?
And I said, well, why don't we keep inventories of stuff? And she said, well, yeah, I could do that. So she did that as kind of a puny example, but I wouldn't have had the idea. But then all the things were inventoried. That wasn't work for me or Jeffrey. It was just regularly done.
Answer not the question. Five words, okay?
Now, to be fair, it's not that I think that Wexner needs any particular incentive or intimidation in order to keep his silence on what he knows about the Epstein operation, given how neck deep, or is it eyeball deep, he was in that operation as potentially the progenitor of that operation. But perhaps just in his senility, he needed his counsel, his legal counsel, to subtly remind him not to go too far with his testimony, right? Anyway, yes, I think we all understand there is a cover-up underway on this issue, and oh yeah, another way to cover up an issue might be to, I don't know, launch a war, potentially World War III, to suddenly make the number one pressing political issue that everyone has their attention focused on, that thing that, oh yeah, I kind of vaguely remember that from the beginning of the year, whatever. Anyway, back to Iran war. So yes, there are many, many ways that a cover-up can be put into action. And we have seen many of those techniques being used in the Epstein case in particular, which is why it's so instructive as an example on this list, and one that is obviously still ongoing. Yes, in case you have been distracted by other things, yes, things that are important that are taking place in the world, but let's not forget that the Epstein investigation cover-up is still ongoing, and different details continue to emerge, and there are still people out there who are doing yeoman's work in exposing that cover-up as it is taking place in real time and putting valuable information out there in the public record. One example of that is Sayer G, who continues to document and really go down the rabbit hole on the Bill Gates Epstein connection and what is being revealed through so many different documents and emails and other things that are coming to light. So I hope people are staying tuned and continuing to follow Sayer G's investigation. And if so, you may have seen this recent article, breaking: Bill Gates will testify before House oversight on June 10th. Here's what the Federal Archive says he'll have to answer for. And it goes through the information that the federal investigators should be looking at and should be pressing Bill Gates on if there was a real investigation going on. Now, obviously, I am not expecting that this will result in the conviction, prosecution of Bill Gates, or really ultimately in anything in a legal sense of Bill Gates. Hopefully, his reputation has been ruined to the point where he can no longer hide behind his philanthropic savior mask, but I'm not holding my breath for any actual justice to come from this cover-up, but maybe some more nuggets of information will come to light. At any rate, we can use this as a teaching opportunity for the general public to teach them about some of the things that Bill Gates has been involved in and how that covers some of the other tentacles of the Epstein operation, not just the political pedophilia blackmail angle, but things like the construction of the pandemic as a business model, which again, Sayer G has been documenting. So I hope people will take a look at that article, spread it to others. I think that this is, again, an instructive example of a cover-up that is taking place in real time. So I think it is something that we can use all of this knowledge from today to bring our resources onto exposing this cover-up as it is happening, which is probably the only time at which you can actively and successfully divert a cover-up operation from taking place. Having said that, there's a lot of information in today's episode, so if you are interested in that information, please go to CorbettReport.com/coverup for the complete hyperlinked transcript. Everything that I say in today's episode, all of the videos that are played, every piece of information linked so you can go follow it through to its source and find more information on every one of these cover-ups. There's a lot more to say about each and every one of them, and I bet that you, whoever you are in the crowd, probably can think of, I don't know, a half dozen, maybe a dozen, maybe 100 other examples of cover-up operations and the things that they can teach us about how these operations work. If you are in that crowd, and if you do, if that is something that pertains to you, then why not share it with others? Log into CorbettReport.com and leave your observations in the comment section. What other cover-ups do you think are good case studies to look at as we go down this cover-up rabbit hole? That being said, I think we're going to leave this exploration here for today. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com, thanking you for investing your time in today's exploration, and I'm looking forward to talking to you again in the near future. Computer whiz kid.
Part of your genius is that you are a computer whiz.
Cutthroat businessman.
The U.S. Justice Department contended that the software giant had breached antitrust laws.
Selfless philanthropist.
Bill, even your harshest critic would have to admit that your philanthropy work is, you know, planet-shaking, incredible.
Ruthless eugenicist.
But that's called the death panel, and you're not supposed to have that discussion.
As more and more of our world is coming to rely on Bill Gates for his guidance.
One of the best informed voices is that of businessman and philanthropist Bill Gates.
It is time to ask what really lies behind Gates' quest for control.
Things won't go back to truly normal until we have a vaccine that we've gotten out to basically the entire world.
It is time to ask, who is Bill Gates? Watch the complete documentary for free at CorbettReport.com/Gates, or support the work and purchase a DVD copy at NewWorldNextWeek.com.